Hello, and welcome back to Eldersign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buddha. In today's episode, we'll be talking about David Farland's 2014 story, Hellfire on the High Frontier.
This story was nominated by one of our Patreon supporters, and then, of course, as this always works, a majority of our other supporters voted for it. And that is a good note, it's a good time to remind you that we, in fact, are voting now, this month, on the stories that will comprise our major theme for next year. So the other way to put this is, this month, we are voting to pick 5 or 6, maybe even 7 stories that we will cover next year, which is to say more than a quarter of what we're going to cover in 2024. So it's a pretty big vote for us. I guess it's a pretty big vote for listeners as well.
We really, really value your participation in the voting process. So I really hope that you'll join us on Patreon. At least go check it out. You won't just be able to vote. There's so many bonus episodes. And your participation is really what makes this network work. So consider supporting us financially as well so you can get involved in the story selection. I don't think we've been let down by our Patreon supporters so far in terms of what they've chosen for us, Glenn. And it's just been one of the absolute highlights and pleasures of my middle-aged life so far is to have people choose stories that are great for us to read. Let's talk a little bit about Hellfire on the High Frontier. This story is part of an anthology. We read it in an anthology called Dead Man's Hand, an anthology of the Weird West. And so, yeah, this is Weird West, a genre I'm only familiar with through the ARPG Grim Dawn. So I was really excited to read this story. And we will be talking about the degree to which this is a weird story or what other types of things are going on in it. So why don't we just jump right into it, Glenn?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this one. And yeah, as you said, this is a Western. And so our story takes place in Wyoming in 1876. Our protagonist is Morgan Gray, Texas Ranger. He is, of course, a long way from Texas, right? I mean, 1,000 miles perhaps from Texas. But as he says several times, justice should not be bound by borders. Also, as we have already said, this is not just a Western, it is a weird Western. And so we are introduced to one of the several weird elements really just right away. Morgan is on a mission to capture a skinwalker, which is to say a human who can become a bear. We're going to get more on this later. But right now, as soon as we turn to the second page of the story, we are introduced to a second weird element. This is someone Morgan calls the Stranger, and here, let me just read a little bit of the text. Suddenly, the Stranger took form across the campfire, a shadow solidifying into something almost human, sitting on a rock. Morgan had met him only once, 7 years back, a man in a black frock like a traveling preacher. He wore his Stetson low over his eyes and had a wisp of dark beard. The spurs on his boots were made of silver, with glowing pinwheels of lightning. The cigar clenched between his teeth smelled of sulfur. Could have been an angel. Could have been the devil. Morgan's gut told him that the Stranger was something different altogether. So that's pretty unsettling there, but the deal is that the Stranger has a job for Morgan, and this job is going to introduce one more weird element, though also not going to be the last of many, many weird elements that we get in this story. But here, what we get is clockworks, which is to say, steampunk androids. Now, these seem to have been built to serve mostly as soldiers. Morgan knew one when he was a Union soldier in the American Civil War. He knows that the Russians used clockworks in the Crimean War. And the clockwork in question here in this story is a former Confederate soldier from the American Civil War. And this clockwork is named Hellfire. Well, that's in the title of the story. Hellfire is something of a serial killer, I guess. Every 4 months, he kills someone, he shoots them, and it's going to be Morgan's job now to hunt him down and stop him, and there is a ticking clock for this mission. He has precisely 4 days, 6 hours, and 7 minutes before Hellfire will kill again. Now, obviously, that is the plot hook, but I have to say here, Brandon, just holy cow, Farland has thrown an absolute ton at us in just 3 pages.
I mean, he has, right? He really has. And any one of these elements are worth exploring in some depth for the story. I mean, like any single one of these elements could take up a whole story by itself. We could ask questions like, who invented clockwork men to fight as soldiers in a war? What's the story behind them becoming normalized? And why has no one created like an off switch or a kill switch? How long have skinwalkers been losing control of themselves to require a ranger to be roped into tracking one every now and then? And that question is really rooted in the fact that skinwalking seems to be rooted in myths of the American Indian and so on. Who was the stranger, if not an angel and a devil? Does the existence of the stranger imply the truth of a sort of mythical Christian framework? You know, all these things kind of ran through my head as we read the first three pages of this story. And while the story won't investigate much of this world-building stuff that Farland packs into these first couple pages, these elements here really do serve to tell us what's important about our main character, Morgan Gray. Namely, that he's a man who was on tilt. You know, things have not been going his way. He's out of his jurisdiction. He's operating beyond his typical boundaries. And yeah, things aren't going well, and they're really about to get worse. At this point in his mission, he's thinking, you know, maybe if I can just hold on to my horse, things are going to be okay. Maybe I can just rest in that. As long as I get out of this thing with my horse, everything will be okay. So yeah, it is very weird in the early going in this story, but I have to say, Glenn, the steampunk element really surprised me. And I think by the end of this story, we are going to have to talk a little bit about how this story might tip into other broader genre categories beside the weird.
Yeah, that's right. I also was surprised by the steampunk element in the story, or the introduction of it. And it happens on page three, right? So it happens pretty early in the story. It's just that we'd already been introduced to two other weird elements that are not steampunk, but that are numinous in some way, right? The ability to shapeshift into an animal, and then also some kind of spectral figure in the stranger. And so it felt like we were in a kind of supernatural horror world. But also it turns out, well, we are, I guess, but then also it turns out that we are in a steampunk world as well. And that was a mashup that I was not expecting. And I will respect your instinct here, Brandon, because I share it, which is to table any more conversation about that until we get to the discussion. So I'll move us along here. And at this point, what's happening is that Morgan has two distinct missions. So he knows that there is a countdown clock for the serial killing robot, the clockwork, but he's also been tracking this skin changer for several months, 4 months, in fact, and now he's finally caught up with him, and he's not going to let that go. So Morgan goes after the skin changer. The skin changer's name here is Coyote Shadow, by the way, though at this point it's clear to Morgan that the skin changer has really lost most of his humanity, like can't actually even turn all the way back into his human form. And at any rate here, how this works out is we get a really excellent multi-day chase through Wind River, which I will say is just absolutely breathtaking country. Farland does a great job of describing it here. But things are not going to work out for Morgan on this hunt. While he is sleeping one night, Coyote Shadow steals Morgan's gear, also steals his horse, and so Morgan just has no other option but to retreat to civilization and go get after Hellfire, this clockwork serial killer.
Yeah, I mean, Morgan missed the one shot that he had to take at Coyote Shadow in order to subdue him or kill him. And then Coyote Shadow just toys with Morgan, steals all of his stuff. And so Farland is really just driving home the fact that Morgan is in one of those downswings that life occasionally tosses your way where it just feels like you cannot get a leg up on anything. And all that's not to say that Morgan has really just lost his horse, the one thing, as I mentioned before, that he was like, if I can just hang on to this, then maybe I can say it wasn't so bad. I promise you, if you're making that kind of bargain with reality, you're going to lose that thing. This has happened to me with a pair of sunglasses in a casino. Don't worry about it. It's a tale for another day, but I understand where Morgan's coming from here in this part of the story.
Yeah, this is, I think, some great detail here about Morgan. I think that many of us are familiar with Westerns really as a type of superhero story, right? Where there's the white hat, a kind of lone ranger type figure who just can't lose is just really awesome at things. And of course, we're going to get the one story where there's, you know, at least in the transition from the second to the third act, some kind of extra tough obstacle of the likes of which they've never encountered before. But of course, they're going to emerge victorious in the end. Farland is not telling that type of story here. Morgan is not the greatest cowboy that there's ever been. He's not the greatest Texas Ranger that there's ever been. He is a flawed character, just in the sense that sometimes he misses shots that he probably ought to be able to make. And in fact, he begins to get riddled with self-doubt here that is going to end up maybe not being his undoing, but contributing to at least the emotional arc of this story.
Yeah, he's not even really all that good of a philosopher, which when you have a good flawed cowboy, like in True Grit or something like that, you have somebody who's got, you know, a philosophy of how to take one person on at a time when you're in a gunfight and so on. Morgan seems to just only think about justice, and that's kind of it. He's like kind of just a man of justice. And one of the things that's come up with his sense of justice is that I guess he's made a deal with the stranger years ago, and now that bill has come due. So like it's come due at the worst possible time in his life. And so that's just where we're at in the story. We're reading a story about a guy who's down on his luck. He's interested in things getting their due. His own bill has come due, and a real theme hasn't emerged yet, but it kind of does in this section. So there's a few things that I do want to point out that occur in this Wind River hunt of Coyote Shadow. So the first thing is that I do think that Farland handles the hunting of Coyote Shadow and Morgan's sense of failure really well on the prose front. There's just some nice writing here that brings you deeper into the setting. But the second thing I want to point out is that we have a clear A and B plot to this story. And I don't know if it's going to come up in the discussion, but we should really talk about how these A and B plots function on the structural level in terms of how our expectations as readers are being handled when we get to the discussion. But the last thing I want to mention is that in this section, we get a dream sequence involving a clockwork soldier getting surgery by what's known as a tinkerman. And that's, you know, some kind of engineer whose job it is to repair clockwork robots. And this tinkerman is trying to put like a real heart in the robot. And in this dream, Morgan is reminded of something that he'd heard during the war, namely that God is dead. And this isn't really like Nietzsche talking or anything like that, but that like literally God has been killed by his own creation. He's been superseded by mankind. And this is where, again, I, you know, we see this theme emerge. You know, this is an important moment in the story because it highlights one, Morgan's anxieties about hunting a clockwork, someone who has been designed by mankind to be a better killer than mankind is, but was also created by people. So this is an important emergence of a theme through a dream that we see in the story, but it also really reminds us how deeply steeped we are in this kind of weird world. One of the things that makes this world so uncanny is that we don't know where any of the weird stuff is coming from.
Right. Some of it seems to be natural in some way. We'll get a little bit more on that in just a little bit. But obviously, some of this is also manufactured. It's you know, what we might call man-made, right, in the form of these clockworks. We then also have to wonder, you know, what are some other steampunk elements that might exist in this world that we're just not seeing in the story, or at least seeing at this point in the story. So yeah, I share all of your questions about that for sure, Brandon. Something else that we do get about Morgan here, at least starting here in this section anyway, is the extent to which his service in the U.S. Civil War, where he was a soldier on the side of the Union, has affected him. I think this is a big part of why he's gone on to be a Texas Ranger, right? This is a job where he gets to have a real clear sense of right and wrong, but also just gets to be alone with his horse in the woods and the, you know, just the wilderness in general for long stretches of time. And that seems to be the way that he likes it. And so it seems pretty clear at this point that Morgan has been, well, pretty traumatized by killing And even though that's still actually kind of his business, he's lost a lot of, I don't know if faith is the right word, but it's what I'm going to use here. He's lost a lot of faith in humanity, a lot of, I guess, sense of beauty and goodness in the world. Doesn't seem to be something that he can see anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he's really just trying to protect civilization. I mean, this is the classic, you know, chivalric knight errant whose sense of the kingdom, because they're not in contact with it, is formed entirely by their ideals. And they kind of need to be outside of the kingdom in order to maintain those ideals. And that's where Morgan's at. I think if he were in more contact with civilization, he wouldn't be able to cling to the ideals that he holds dear. And those ideals are like the only thing he really has left. So this is classic Western writing, as Westerns are informed by tropes of chivalric romance.
Yeah, well, let's get to civilization here, because Morgan needs to get to the nearest town because he's got no horse and he's got no gun. When he does get to the nearest town, though, he actually finds not just a gun, but in fact, his own gun, his own rifle. It's for sale. And so he knows that Coyote Shadow has already been here ahead of him and pawned the rifle that he stole. But what I really want to note is that in this store, this very same store here in this town, Morgan also finds some Thunderbird eggs. And these Thunderbirds are called by Mexicans Quetzals. And so that is obviously here another weird element to this story, this kind of mythical, supernatural flaming birds here. But that's really just kind of a side note, because of course, what we're really here for are Hellfire and the High Frontier. So let's go get to both of those elements. Hellfire, that's this clockwork, I'll remind people. Hellfire is in Fort Laramie, or at least he was in Fort Laramie. Morgan, it turns out, ran out of time. And so Hellfire has killed again. He's killed again here in Fort Laramie. And it turns out that the person he killed was a prostitute whom Morgan has some affection for. And so he is doubly upset about having allowed the clock to run out on him. The good news is that everyone knows exactly where Hellfire went. But the bad news is that that place is not easily accessible. And so now we're going to get the final weird element of this story. And this is the High Frontier, which is the name of a world that exists in the clouds. And here again, I'm just going to read some text. I'm going to let Farland introduce this to us himself. One could only find the High Frontier at that time of day, when the sun had set and the full moon was poised to rise on the far side of the earth. It was a magical place, nestled in the clouds. Down below the skyship, a silver city rose, elegant spires like fairy castles with windows lit up like gemstones. The colored glass in those windows made it look as if sapphires, rubies, and diamonds were scattered over the city. The skyship landed amid glorious swirling clouds, and the rich folk marched down the promenade arm in arm, laughing and joking and celebrating their good fortune. On the deck, the band came out and played soft chamber music. Women oohed and aahed at the spectacle, while men stood open-mouthed. Morgan imagined that saints might make such sounds as they entered heaven. The High Frontier had only been discovered 4 years back. Who had built the silver castles? No one knew. How the cities of stone floated in the clouds was also a mystery. Angels lived there, scrawny girls with wings, ethereal in their beauty. But they were feral creatures, barbaric. And it was said that when the first explorers had entered the Silver City, the angels were roosting over the arches, little more than filthy pigeons. Some thought that it had once been an outpost, that perhaps angels had once been wiser, more civilized, and that they rested here while carrying messages back and forth between heaven and earth. And I guess I should also emphasize here as well that this is a weird West that has dirigibles. I guess that's another kind of steampunk element. But all right, let's really bring this story to a close so that we can go get to the discussion, which I think we're both actually very eager to do. We've been kind of biting our tongues while we've been talking about the story as we go through it. So Morgan finds Hellfire in the saloon up here in the clouds. There is a showdown. Morgan knows that he cannot win this showdown, and there's actually also quite a bit of taunting from Hellfire. Some pretty great taunting, in fact, and I'm sure that we will take up the topic of creators in the discussion. But knowing that he can't win does not help Morgan at all, even though that's actually kind of what I expected while this was all getting drawn out. And so in the end, Morgan shoots at Hellfire, but to absolutely no effect. And then Hellfire shoots him dead. And that is the end of the story.
Yeah, there's a lot to take up here in the last bit of the story, and this, that's going to, you know, lead into our discussion. So there's just a few things I want to highlight, I guess, before we hop into it. The first really just occurred to me as I was listening to you reading about this city, you know, because, you know, when sometimes it's nice to just hear people read descriptions of things, you encounter them in a new way, and just how much of the description of the city is tied to imagery that comes from the Book of Revelation about the New Jerusalem. I think you also find some of that in like Peter's letters about, you know, streets lined with gemstones and the buildings are made of precious metals and so forth. But then also the fact that it's in the clouds and in the Christian New Testament. And we'll talk about maybe some of this a little bit. As David Farland was a writing instructor at BYU, Brandon Sanderson actually took David Farland's position, you know, which is the Mormon University. But like how clouds are a symbol of justice and judgment in the Bible. So there's like a lot of imagery here that I think you can draw from Christianity or Mormonism. But yeah, as you pointed out, Glenn, the city is made of silver. Silver is also mentioned in connection to the stranger with whom Morgan has made this deal. We've got these angels as a kind of, you know, really taxonomified, I don't know, material being. And regarding angels, Morgan thinks of the Christian Bible, in which he thinks about the order of being where God is at the top, then angels, then men, and then beasts, right? So that's kind of the classic order of being within something like Orthodox Christianity. But God is dead, the angels are feral, and they're knowable. And, you know, who really knows what all these things are? Like, why this taxonomy? Why this order of being? And maybe that's the first question I want to ask here, Glenn, as we move into the discussion, which I think will be pretty wide-ranging. So here's as good a place to start as any. With all of this hierarchy of being stuff in the story, is the religiously connoted language here that Farland uses meant to be taxonomical, or is it meant to be evocative and suggestive? And this might not matter in the grand scheme of things, but this really feels important in the way that Farland is conceiving of the world as having these beings that are these in-between beings in the hierarchy of being, by which I mean angels in between man and God, and then skinwalkers in between beast and man. But then we see that there's this scientific cast of mind that's applied to this hierarchy. I guess, I don't know, does my question make any sense? But if not, maybe I can find another way to approach it. It just seems like this old hierarchy of being is really important to Farland. But there's a scientific taxonomy here as well. But then it's all caught up in magic. I don't know. Am I making sense?
You are. Let me see if I can translate that question just a little bit here, or reframe it, really. And because I think that in some way what you're asking here is, do all of these elements here, the way that they're presented in this kind of hierarchical sense, you know, putting together an actual taxonomy of life forms that includes angels, God, clockworks, also skin changers, ghosts maybe, and so on, is that simply the way that Morgan is thinking about the world here in the story? Or is this actually meant to be an objective representation of the way that this world functions that we're getting from an omniscient and maybe also omnipotent narrator here, right? And so my sense is actually that it is the latter, that Farland is thinking about this world actually working in this way, that this being the real truth of the world, that God existed in some sense as a material being who is now dead. These angels are, you know, not just being called angels by people, but in fact, this idea that these are the angels that we've read about in scripture, but that, you know, what's gone wrong with them is that, well, God is dead, and so they haven't been cared for, and they've gone feral in some way, that those things are literally true. That's literally what's going on here, or objectively what's going on here in the world, and that humans are discovering this now. And that the reason they're discovering this, of course, is because of the industrial age, right? That in 1876, here in this story, we are a full century into the Industrial Revolution. We're actually solidly in the second phase of the Industrial Revolution. We are actually getting as well what people often call the second scientific revolution that goes hand in hand with this. And so I think that Farland is telling us here a story, a weird Western story, that is very much about humans discovering the real nature of the cosmos. And that part of the real nature of the cosmos is that God is dead. The angels have turned into wild animals, and we're left alone. We're left to our own devices here. And oh, by the way, we have devised so many new ways of really effectively, really efficiently killing large numbers of ourselves. And one of them, we actually made a sentient thinking machine that can decide to do that on its own. So yeah, that's my sense of how all this works.
Yeah, that's a great point. It is so strange. I kind of got waylaid, I think, in my approach to this story by Farland's emphasis on this kind of hierarchy of being stuff. I really love to see that in fiction. Walker Percy does this a lot. He thinks a lot about, you know, man being a little less than angels and a little more than beasts, you know. And I think, I think we've lost something maybe as a people by not having hierarchies of being. Maybe, but maybe not. It's always hard to say. But the emphasis on everything being open to being within a taxonomy is a strange way of thinking. And I think that is also what Farland is up to here, is making strange this kind of urge that's caught up in scientific thinking or scientism to have everything categorizable. And it's something that I like that Farland is doing in this story. I want to move now to thinking about the last line of this story, which is this. This line is spoken or written after Hellfire kills Morgan Gray. And the last line of the story then is this: thus a new wonder in the world supplanted and old. And this is a motif that I tried to point out earlier that we find also in the dream that Morgan has when he's thinking about what has happened to God. And so this last line and the way that this is maybe a theme of the story, or at least a motif, puts me in mind of two things. The first thing that has come to my mind will, I think, keep us on track of what we've been talking about, which is, you know, maybe what is the theme of this story? What's going on with this hierarchy of being and the focus on it? And ultimately, I think I can phrase it like this. Would you say, Glenn, perhaps that a theme of this story might be, you know, the old chestnut from Frankenstein, be careful when you're playing God? Or do you think that Farland has more in mind here thematically in writing this story?
Well, I definitely think that be careful what you create, right, is definitely part of what's going on here. Thinking about this again in terms of the Industrial Revolution, and then therefore just the world that we are living in of the post-Industrial Revolution, or I don't know, maybe we're in the fifth Industrial Revolution. I don't know, the Digital Revolution, of course, right, is I guess what we're living through right now. Anyway, the point is that I think Farland here is looking back and using this story as a microcosmic way of examining the world that we made in the 19th century and thinking about whether or not it is a good world. And, you know, that's not here, I think, quite on the surface, because we don't get anything about our own contemporary world. But, you know, the writing of this story, the early 2010s, I think that was a pretty good time for people to be thinking about that sort of thing, right? This was the point at which the digital age had really come down on us, that suddenly we were all looking at, you know, gee-jaws that we keep in our pockets all the time. Netflix wasn't even sending you DVDs in the mail anymore. You know, now it was just everything was streaming, right? I think this was a real age where, a real time, you know, a decade or so ago, where someone might actually be thinking about the world that we have wrought and carry that with them to writing a story about the Weird West. But I also think there probably is more to it than that, as you are suggesting.
Yeah, I think there has to be. I mean, like we said, I mean, there's all the tropes and so forth that Farland is playing with that are, you know, rooted in the Western story, kind of the lone wanderer, as you point out. But then there's all the steampunk stuff, which is caught up in a technological revolution, a way to explore technological revolutions. And so, I think Farland has a lot on his mind, but maybe we can get into that a little bit with the framing of the second thing that is brought to my mind by the end of this story, the line at the end of this story. And that's maybe thinking about what the source of the weird actually is in this story. You know, there seems to me to be a few potential stories. There's this kind of trope involving what if, you know, indigenous person's magic was real. There's the killing of the Judeo-Christian god. There's all the Silver City stuff, which we've tied to, you know, hierarchy of being, but also the stranger. So I guess the question, the way I want to investigate this is asking you, you know, how does the weird play into the bigger thematic creation stuff? Or like, maybe what is the source of the weird in this story?
Right. There are two types of weird element here. One of them is supernatural, and the other one is, well, it's not natural, I guess. It's mechanical, right? It's engineering. And so on the one hand, we have things like the stranger, who is some kind of, you know, phantom or specter, ghost of some sort. And then we also have the skin changers, and we have the Thunderbirds, the Quetzals here, though I guess in some sense those might actually be natural rather than supernatural, at least some of them. But so maybe actually the dichotomy I'm looking at here is really not supernatural versus natural, but is organic versus mechanical. So let's say that, organic versus mechanical. And so we've got this world in which the west of North America is itself a really fascinating, really mysterious place that is full of creatures, full of beings that people in drawing rooms in London just can't really reckon with, can't really even imagine. But in the middle of the 19th century, people are coming out to this area to settle. They're discovering that these stories of Quetzals, these stories of humans who can change into bears or other types of animals, that these are actually true, that this world, the world of Western North America, is a kind of land of magic in some way, or numinousness in some way. That's one of the weird elements that we have here. The other weird element that we have here, though, right, is this mechanical stuff. It's humans have figured out how to do all sorts of engineering that one is actually making the world of the organic weird more accessible. This includes the West itself, but then of course also includes this high frontier. This is a place that has seemingly always existed, right? But humans have only just now devised a way to get there. But also this includes all of the killing machines. And of course, the most important killing machine is the one that also can think and act on its own. That is to say, the clockworks. But also things like the Gatling gun and all sorts of other devices that were invented in the middle of the 19th century, put into practice, put into use in the American Civil War. And so I guess my sense of this last line here is that it's not just about clockworks supplanting humans. It's actually about the world of engineering in general supplanting the organic world, right? That this is about humans have invented all of these machines that are diminishing, I think, even the wonder of the organic world, minimizing it, perhaps putting it into a kind of reservation status, right? Shrinking, actually, the area of wild organicness or organic wildness, I guess, and making this a world of machines, but also at the same time, realizing that humans, we ourselves are part of this organic world and that we have, we have sown our own undoing here.
If you think of something like, you know, humans in Farland's taxonomy here, Farland's hierarchy of being here, humans being made in the image of God, you know, frees humans to be multifaceted, to have all take on all these aspects of the world around them, in a sense, because God created everything. And so we can adapt our image or so forth, or take on different modes of being. But when humans in Farland's story here create something in their image, it's purely just kind of for killing. It's just a smart killing machine. And so, yeah, Farland is looking probably at the history of the 20th century and the technological revolution tied to war in some way. Our tools are kind of more killing machines and that sort of thing. But also, I wonder, if the death of God has played a role in this in some way, in the diminishment of the weird magic and the rise of humans making in their own image. I mean, and in that way, I think we are looking at that kind of nihilistic Nietzschean critique of modernity. I don't know if that was a question, but I'll give you a breath to respond here.
Well, I wonder about this. I wonder if God being dead really matters in this world, right? Because if God being dead really matters in this world, right? If God's death is how we get Clockworks, then that means that Farland is envisioning here a world in which God is, or has been until recently, actively participating in the world, like still actually bringing change in the world, still guiding humans in some way. Now, of course, that actually is a Mormon belief, right? I mean, the proper name of the Mormon church is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The idea being that there are still saints. God is still, in fact, imbuing people with holy power, with numinous power. The church is led by a prophet, that is to say, someone who is actually in some kind of contact with God, I think usually envisioned as a kind of unidirectional contact with God, as in the prophet is set to receive, but not set to send so much. And so I think that is something that we can see here, right? Is that if we're thinking about this story as a kind of Mormon story, a kind of Mormon speculative fiction story, then we might see that here in the root of this, right? That this really is about the actual absence of God. I didn't really feel that way while I was reading the story, though, I will say, but it seems like maybe you did. Maybe you did kind of get that sense from the story.
I mean, I was just deeply interested in where for Farland the weird emerged. And it seemed to me as though it had something to do with the death of God. That's kind of his explanation. But it seems like all the Native American magic stuff kind of was outside of that in some way. And I mean, that felt like kind of weirdly Mormon to me in a way I can't quite put my finger on. Maybe it was some book covers of some, you know, Orson Scott Card novels about you know, Indian tribes or whatever. But it seems to me as though there's this more Mormon overlap in the story that I just didn't really have the time to explore, because what I ended up thinking a lot about was something we haven't really talked about for a while on the show, which is the weird to wonder spectrum. And this is kind of want to take us back to our roots a little bit as investigating weird fiction as it emerged from these kind of early magazines, Amazing Tales, Weird Tales, and so forth. And I wonder, Glenn, when reading a tale like we've just read, where you'd place it on the spectrum. Would this get published in Weird Tales, or would it get published in Amazing Tales?
Right. Yeah, this is a great question. And you know, as with most of the stories that we cover, I think you could make a case for either one, right? I think either editor could grab this story. But I think my sense is that this leans Weird Tales, right? Because even the wonder element of it here really is the human achievement of inventing machines, inventing the clockworks, and also inventing dirigibles. But the result of both of those inventions is a kind of horror, right? We have invented a machine that turns out to be a serial killer. And then what we use the dirigibles for is to go and find out that heaven is empty, or at least it's empty of God. And the angels are still there, but it turns out they're just feral pigeons, essentially, right? That actually what we've done is use this wondrous machine or these wondrous machines to discover something that's utterly horrifying. So I think this uses some of the tropes of wonder fiction, but ultimately does it to give us a weird and unsettled feeling.
Yeah, I disagree. To me, this was a wonder story through and through. And it was because of the way that Farland and then maybe also Gray himself were constantly imbued with this sense of awe of the world they're in, rather than and being able to face the weird stuff sort of head on. To me, the underlying emotion of the story is awe and not harder. So that's funny. I guess two wildly different ways in which we came away from this story.
Yeah, let me think about that a little bit more, because I guess my sense here was that, you know, right, there's no cosmic horror element here, right? So this is not a type of weird story in which our protagonist is going to faint because he learns that the world isn't actually what he thinks the world is, or the cosmos isn't what he thinks the cosmos is. Even discovering that God is dead, or thinking about God being dead, isn't driving him to some kind of, you know, Lovecraftian madness or fainting spells. But I think that what makes Morgan Gray capable of facing the world of the weird head on, or you know, face forward like this, is that, well, that experience already happened to him when he was in the war, right? I think the backdrop here of the Civil War and the horror of that, the trauma of that, of this first war of machines, this first industrial war, major industrial war, has already traumatized him. And so he's become immune to it. And this is what makes him good at being a Texas Ranger who can deal with ghosts and shapeshifters, and also the right person to go try to face down this clockwork as well. And so here I see him as this paladin figure, which we were talking about earlier, or chivalric hero, but really of the hardboiled detective variety. Right, the Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler type of hardboiled detective, maybe even especially the Dashiell Hammett type, is someone who has been to the war, in this case really being the First World War, and come back jaded from that. But that jadedness also means that they can't get damaged anymore by discovering the ugly truths of the world, and that makes them great detectives. I think that's the same blueprint of character here as well.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I guess maybe I was in awe of what Farland had created here so much and balanced it so well, where you wanted to know more about the world, but he kept the story so character focused that you were okay with the character journey, and you didn't need him to go on a picaresque and, you know, find the first inventor of, you know, of the first clockwork or whomever, whatever. I don't know. I assume his name would be the same name of the man who invented Data, you know, in Star Trek or something like that, you know?
Right. Soon. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, I guess I only have one more question, and it's because David Farland is a new author on the show for us. Have you read David Farland before? Do you have a relationship with him?
I have not read any David Farland before. And as I was getting ready for us to do this episode today, I couldn't remember if the nomination of this story came as a result of the news of his passing in early 2022. I don't know if that was coincidental or if that was part of the impetus here. I suspect probably it was. And so, yeah, this was the first David Farland story that I'd ever read. And I feel like I missed out on the David Farland fandom when stories could be, you know, still appearing. I would love for us to read more from him. I was looking at his bibliography a little bit, and actually it looks like there's some really fantastic stuff, including some short story collections, maybe something I could do on ATOS. So yeah, if people are interested in David Farland, I would love to do more.
Yeah, I had only really read part of the first Rune Lords novel. You know, that was kind of his big epic fantasy series. The covers of those novels were illustrated in the same style, if not by the same artist who did, you know, the original Wheel of Time covers. So it was kind of caught up in that moment in that period of epic fantasy in the 90s. He was kind of in competition with Robert Jordan, it seemed to me. And, you know, the Rune Lord novels have great titles. One of them is like Brotherhood of the Wolf, which is probably what drew me to them. But yeah, I've not really dug into him. And what an imagination, really. And also, like, what a position he was in, to be the creative writing instructor at BYU, who taught Brandon Sanderson, and then Brandon Sanderson took over that course and became a major novelist, you know, in his own right. So just a kind of big figure looming over epic fantasy, at least, or speculative fiction in the 90s that's had a major impact on the scene. Yeah, but I've read almost none of him, just about half of that first Rune Lords novel. It ended up being a little more court intrigue than I was in the mood for at the time I picked it up. So I put it down and I haven't picked it up again, but I kind of feel like I have a new appreciation for David Farland. This story is a really great work of imagination.
It is. It's it's a great work of imagination. Also, I felt like the prose was really great. I liked the characterization as well. This is the rare short story that I actually wished had been a novel. Most of the time I read a novel and think, that could have been a short story. But in this case, I wanted this short story to actually be expanded into a novel because I wanted so much more about this world. I don't know if there is any more about it. That's something maybe we can ask listeners to let us know. I also, in addition to hoping that we get a chance in the future to read more David Farland, I hope we get to read more weird Westerns. We've been talking about Westerns quite a bit lately because we've also just finished covering a study in Scarlet, the very first Sherlock Holmes novel that turns out is at least one third a Western. We were both kind of surprised by that. So we've been thinking about Westerns a lot, have talked about our experiences and relationship with Westerns. And I would like to be doing more, reading more Weird West, which is a genre that I don't know all that well. This and I guess The Gunslinger are really probably as much Weird West as I've ever read. I've seen some on screen, but I know that there's much more to read. I guess for one, we could read the rest of this anthology, which is something that would be very cool. I'd also love to read Westworld by Michael Crichton. I've seen, I guess, the most recent HBO TV show, or at least, one season of it, I should say. But I have no idea really what that book is about. But this is a genre of speculative fiction that I guess waxes and wanes, but certainly has a lot of entries in it. And I have read almost none of it.
Yeah, I'm like only glancingly familiar with its presence on film. Bone Tomahawk was a pretty big movie, I remember, in the horror circles, but I didn't see it. I'd love to see it. And then, Grim Dawn, I mentioned that game at the top of the show. That's a Diablo-style Weird West, Lovecraftian monsters versus numinous figures versus humans, gunplay, running around, picking up loot type of game. The writing in that game is actually incredible. I, within playing it for an hour or two, I was like, I need to actually read every single word, every book that I pick up in this game, every journal entry, because the writing is creepy and spooky and fantastic. And you track people's demise and descent into madness as the Lovecraftian invaders continue to take over the world. It's a great game if you're into weird Westerns. It's a great game if you're into Diablo-style dungeon crawlers and loot-based games. Anyway, I don't know. We're talking about other media right now, which is usually a sign that we have to end the episode today that we're doing. So that is going to do it for this episode. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. As always, you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. And please do join us on Patreon at patreon.com/claytemplemedia so that you can vote on next year's themes. And next time, we're going to be back with another story that's going to have us thinking about industrialized warfare. This is The Vampire Salamander by Leon Bloy. And until then, we greet you and say farewell.